So let's engage in this study, but we'll take refuge together, we'll say some prayers, and then we'll get into it. So please, just get comfortable in your seat. Yeah. So have your back straight and your shoulders relaxed. And then if you like, you can close your eyes. And while your body breathes itself, just become aware of the movements that take place when you inhale and exhale the breath. And then relax into awareness itself. And from the state of awareness, imagine the space and the ground around you are completely purified. So space is full of rainbows and offerings, and the ground itself is lapis lazuli and soft and smooth. And you're surrounded by all sentient beings. In the space above you, you can see there's a throne, there's a lotus, sun and moon seat on that throne, and sitting on the moon seat is Lama Tsongkhapa. And he's surrounded by the assembly of direct and indirect teachers, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, deities and Dharma protectors. And you bring to mind how wonderful it is and fortunate that we are all still alive today. That we all have the leisure and opportunity to attain our spiritual goals, and we've brought a sense of urgency to do this. Although things do not exist as they seem to, and though things are not quite right, we do have, and we have met and trust a spiritual guide who is leading all of us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. So recollect your understanding of emptiness, and then see yourself as clear as a deity holding a vajra and bell, and practicing purely for the benefit of all sentient beings. And then from the depths of your heart, say, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And from the heart of Lama Tsongkhapa and all the enlightened beings surrounding him, lights and nectars are streamed down. These dissolve into yourself and all the beings surrounding you. And all negative karmas and obstructions are purified, and your lifespan and good health, along with your Dharma realizations, are increased. So cleansed by love and compassion, and empowered with wisdom, Recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. Decide to develop these four immeasurable thoughts yourself and to establish all beings in the four immeasurable states. And enjoy me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Again, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. These dissolve into yourself and all the beings surrounding you. The negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your good health, your lifespan, and all Dharma realizations and virtues are increased. So you relax a little more. Invite the field for accumulating merit, and under their gaze, you say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So to prevent us clinging to the purification and the accumulation of merit to be truly real, we try to stop all appearances of the samsaric world and of true existence. We imagine that the appearance of the world itself, all of our enjoyments and our merits, are utterly transformed into a pure land, which we offer to Lama Tsongkhapa and his entourage. And we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamnerya Tayomi. Now from the heart of the Lama, a replica moves through space, comes to the bottom of the crown of your head, and comes down through your body to rest at your heart. Light rays from Lama Tsongkhapa at the heart fill your body and all of space so that you are utterly transformed into the Lama and all beings surrounding you are enlightened. You can hear the you can hear the mantra resounding throughout space. And you join in saying, Ama Guru Vajradhara Sumati Kirti Siddhi Hum. Ama Guru Vajradhara Sumati Kirti Siddhi Hum. Ama Guru Vajradhara Sumati Kirti Siddhi Hum. Now the light begins to return from the 10 directions of space. All beings with their enlightened qualities are drawn back into your heart. find yourself breathing normally and naturally, and can feel the seat beneath you and your body moving in harmony with your breath. You know that this meditation was one of imagination, but knowing that, you've imprinted the mind with this potential to actualize. We also understand that the embodiment of enlightenment will require us training in the Dharma, and we're willing to do that. So now breathe in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth, and in your own time, just let your eyes flutter open. So up to day 18, this is one of those days we're going to try and do all the questions. There's 16 of them here. We'll just see how we go. There are actually nine, but when I break them all apart, we get 16 of them. So we'll just go through. And basically, you can divide this all up into two sections. One is on this quote of Chandrakirti's, where he says, "I say they exist for the effect, even though they do not. Taking the perspective of the world, I speak of a self." So there's quite some commentary about that and what that might actually mean. And then after that's done, there's another part where Lama Tsongkhapa goes over the refutations, refutes all the misconceptions about what the meaning of this is, and then lays out the middle way consequence position. The major refutation we're dealing with here is the misunderstanding that the middle way really have no thesis. They're not putting forward any ideas of how they think things exist or don't exist. So our first question says on page 239, Chandrakirti states, "I say they exist for the effect, even though they do not. Taking the perspective of the world, I speak of a self." Now the opponent takes what Chandrakirti says and uses it to assert what? Bruce, what do you think?
I think they assert inherent existence.
Okay. Chris?
Yes, they do exert inherent existence, and it comes across as one positive phenomena as lacking intrinsic nature. Only by the purview of reasoned knowledge that properly analyzes whether such a nature exists, not the purview of ordinary conventional consciousness, because then reasoned knowledge would be pointless.
Sue?
They assert that conventional realities like cause and effect are mere concessions to the worldly perspective, not the the prasangikas, that they accept them, you know, generally. And they also reject conventional existence, do not exist.
Okay, anyone else? Linda?
Right down the bottom of my answer, which is long, it says that the middle way consequences do not accept conventionalities that are capable of withstanding rational analysis. Good question. I don't know.
Fair enough. That's what I'm asking everybody now, because the answers were quite different. Caroline, did you have a chance to have a look through this and maybe conclude?
Well, I think it's sort of like, when you read what they say, like what Chandrakirti says, at face value, it sort of, doesn't kind of, you know, I speak of a self as if it's sort of a inherently existent self, but he's not speaking as a self in that way. It's a little about trying to get across that there's a conventional self, but it doesn't exist inherently. But you have to say that the quotes are sort of ambiguous and leave themselves open for the autonomous saying, aha. So, yeah, I find it strange the way he expresses some things and then has to explain what he says.
Yeah, so the thing to remember here is that, like, this is coming from the point of view of the opponent. Right? It's the other person. So
that's the confusing thing about you have to, I keep losing who's speaking.
That's exactly right. And that's the, you're right, that's the hardest bit to work out who's speaking. And this is why the commentary is so important, and try and find out, is there anywhere in there I can find out, you know? Because I've heard it said a number of times, Gestur has to clear that up for us. I know that was one of the problems up at CI. We just didn't know who's saying what. You know, and when they say it, what does that mean? So so I've got a completely different answer here. And it's because, I guess, my focus is on this part where it says, I say they exist for the effect, even though they do not. It's even though they do not that my focus is upon. So what the opponent is getting at is the middle way have no assertions. So remember, we'll look at the context that this conversation is taking part in, and this is the context. But the argument, do the middle way have any thesis at all to put up? And this is their argument, right? The other guys are going, you guys don't have a position. And this is what this guy is saying, you know. Of course, Lama Song Kapa, as we go through, is going to refute that and point out, of course we do. We just don't have assertions that involve inherent existence.
But Eddie, how does that quote, I say they exist for the effect even though they do not, how is that saying the middle way have no assertions?
Remember, this from the point of view of the opponent.
But even then, if it is from the idea of from the opponent, then how do them saying that, how does that come to the conclusion that middle way's got no assertions?
Which is, even though they do not. That's the little part, even they do not. So Lama Song Kapa is here saying, or Chandrakirti is saying, what he means by do not is we do not have any assertions, we do not have any thesis involving inherent existence. Because all these other guys are saying that things do inherently exist. They've gone further, gone, so you guys don't have anything to say then.
So you're basically saying that other than the middle way consequent school, all the other schools are saying that things inherently exist?
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's it. And so that little line, even though they do not, that's Chandrakirti saying, even though they do not exist inherently. And the opponent is saying, therefore you don't have anything to say. There's nothing you can say then, because there is nothing that exists if that's the case. If conventional phenomena don't inherently exist, they don't exist at all. That's why you have no thesis.
Yeah, so, but in response to what you said to Delma, that they'd say it's, you have to always remember, don't you, that it's conventionally only that they say that things inherently exist. They accept that ultimately things don't inherently exist.
Yeah.
So this is all at the conventional level we're talking here.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
At the conventional level, Chandrakirti is saying phenomena don't inherently exist. And because he says that, then these other guys say, well, you can't have any thesis, can you?
Mm.
Yeah. Anyway, it's just something that, you know, like I said, we're just first time going through, trying to get something about it.
Yeah.
So the next part goes, what does Chandrakirti mean by taking the perspective of the world? Sue, would you like to have a go at this? Did you have a chance of having a look for an answer?
What Chandrakirti means by taking the perspective of the world is that it refers to conventional reality as experienced by an ordinary being through an unimpaired sense of perceptions, such as seeing a vase or recognizing yourself.
Yeah, excellent. Is everybody okay with that? Because that's basically the answer. Yeah. So a phenomenon exists conventionally from the perspective of ordinary experience, and these ordinary experiences have no own character. They don't exist inherently.
But that's where they also introduce that thing of conventional consciousness. Unimpaired conventional consciousness seems to be important.
Yeah, but it's like the meaning of what that means, because from the other schools, unimpaired means inherently existent.
Oh.
Yeah, sure. There's nothing wrong with their consciousness. They're seeing everything as inherently existent, and they do exist that way. The simple way, for me at least, is those who are right there, it's the middle way consequence. There's just no inherent existence. At every other school, there is to some degree. And in here, the degree is conventional consciousnesses. And the other schools say, yes, it's an unimpaired sense consciousness. It's perceiving inherent existence. There's nothing wrong with that. Phenomena do inherently exist. So this is where we get this little thing coming up later where we say, so we have unimpaired sense consciousnesses which are mistaken. So the next little part of this quote, how should we interpret the phrase, even though they do not exist, in this Chandrakirti's quote? Linda, this is, we'll probably be able to do this one.
Wrong button. So even though they do exist, they do not exist inherently, they do exist.
Excellent, that's it. That's right. They do exist. They don't have their own, they don't have any own character, or they don't inherently exist. And they do exist. So that's this first little bit. I just thought we'd just have a little break here and go, okay, so that was about that quote. Is there anything you'd like to ask about it, or what do you think that you found a bit, I don't know, messy, interesting, whatever.
Messy.
Yeah, that's right, Linda.
Sorry, I thought I was muted.
That's true.
Whoops, sorry.
Quite messy.
Next time I go off.
But it's accepting at this stage that, you know, we still see appearances as if they inherently exist. We haven't got to the stage of being able to, we might intellectually know they don't, but it's appearances. Our experience of appearances is the same, in fact, as an autonomist.
That's right. Yeah, which is great in a way for us, because as you know, the object to be refuted is right in front of us. Okay, let's do a quick meditation then, just on this little section. So just again, just get comfortable. Let your body breathe itself. Then with the mind, it seeks enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Bring to mind this quote of Chandrakirti's, where he says, I say they exist for the effect, even though they do not. I say they exist for the effect, even though they do not. Say they exist for the effect, even though they do not. Taking the perspective of the world, I speak of a self. So just think now about how conventional reality appears to us. Conventional reality is the objects, people, and experiences that make up our lives. So when you observe your thoughts, do your thoughts appear to exist from their own side? When you observe yourself, does self appear to exist without any dependence upon your body and mind and the word self itself? In other words, does self appear to have its own character, its own nature? It's right there, just waiting to be named, or it's already named. So you're just looking at your own experience of your thoughts and yourself. You might be able to notice how the sense of thought, the conceptual ideas and sense of self can actually shift, can actually be transformed dependent on conditions and context. This will show you that self and thought has no intrinsic existence, no own character. Notice how your own dependence, your identity and thoughts depend upon relationships, circumstances and perceptions. So these conventionalities are empty of own character, own nature. So there's no own nature. Self has no own nature, own character. Thoughts don't have their own character. Emotions have no own character, even though they always appear to have own character. So you notice this discrepancy between appearance and reality. And then just breathing in through your nostrils. I exhale and just bring your awareness back to your screen. So I was talking to somebody the other day about facts, you know, like a fact, right? This is a fact. And so she mentioned that, you know, we're looking, when you look at phenomena to be objectively, you're trying to bring about, you know, facts. And I said to her, yeah, but the facts have no objective existence. So you try to be objective to have a fact, and then when you do, that fact appears objectively, but it has no objective existence. And so what I said to her was, you know, whatever object you look at, there's lots of facts about an object. So if you change the fact that you look at, it changes how you experience the object. Does this make sense to you? Because, you know, like for you and I, right, we can, one of the facts about you and I is we are impermanent, aren't we? We're subject to change. That's a fact. Another fact is that we're empty of intrinsic nature. That's another fact, right? But so you've got two facts there. There's impermanence is not this, it's not an ultimate truth like emptiness is. Right? So depending upon where you place your attention or what fact you wish to look at, and you're going to get a different type of experience. Anyway, just put that aside, something to think about if you'd like to. So here is this, the question was, the objection on page 241 questions why middle-way consequentialists reject autonomous reasons despite accepting three points about those reasons. So what are the three points? And here they are. They accept that there is a thesis. They accept there's a predicate of the thesis called the property of the probandum. And lastly, they do accept that reason proves the thesis. I know, Sue. It's like funny, eh? And of course, the major thing about the middle way and what differentiates them with the autonomous is the autonomous are saying this exists inherently. And the middle way going, no, it doesn't. We see it being, it doesn't have that type of existence. It's empty of any of its own character, but it is a dependent arising. Our next question, which is part of that first one, I think it's, so how do middle way consequentialists respond to the objection of the autonomists? Oh, yeah, which is, you know, remember the third misinterpretation, which claims that middle way schools have no thesis. They have no possessions, no assertions or positions. Linda, would you like to have a, if this question was reasonably clear to you?
So the middle way consequence, they're saying that we do have a thesis,
That's right. We
don't agree with your thesis, which is that these three things exist inherently.
Excellent.
We say they exist, yeah, but they're not inherently existing.
That's right. That's right. Now you got it.
Right?
That's it. That's right. Yeah, yeah. That's right. So remember, the thesis is a conventionality, isn't it? Yeah. And so these other guys are saying, well, conventionalities appear and intrinsically exist or have their own character, and they do exist that way. So we're not wrong there. Middle way disagree. Now, why do the middle way reject these autonomous reasons? Chris, would you like to have a go at this one?
Yes, because autonomous means inherent existence. So if one accepts that the reasons and three criteria exist inherently, then this is an autonomous reason and it's not accepted by the middle way consequent school.
Yep, that's basically it. That's right. That's dead right. They presuppose the phenomena inherently exist, and so no, we can't accept that. Next question is, why does the stated objection miss the point? Bruce, would you like to have a shot at this one?
You can use something like inherent existence to prove or disprove a point.
Yes, you can.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's as far as I got them.
Okay, that's great. Yeah. That's correct. That's correct. The objection that the middle way autonomists are putting up, which like I said, miss the point, is because when the middle way consequence say we have no thesis. So when Nagarjuna or the middle way say we have no thesis, what does that mean? It means, Sue?
Don't have an inherently existent thesis.
That's right. We do not have any thesis that exists inherently. We have no inherently existent thesis. So when the middle way autonomists hear this, what do they think this means? What does that mean to them? Chris?
You have no thesis.
Exactly, that's right. So this is what they make the mistake. They conflate the absence of inherent existence with the absence of all positions. All conventions are out the window if they don't inherently exist. That's right. Nice and succinct, Chris. That's right. And so again, they make this, you know, they misunderstand the nature of the thesis. The other schools can misunderstand like the nature. The other schools are all saying the nature is that they intrinsically exist. The middle way consequence is going, they don't. And so here, Bruce comes this one, words lacking inherent nature can refute it. You're right. This is precisely why they can refute it, right? Because they lack inherent existence.
So Eddie, is it because the consequentialists are saying that things without, if you don't posit inherent existence, then things can't function?
Yep,
is that part of it?
For sure. Yeah. So remember when some time back we did that analysis of the, if something were to inherently exist, it could only exist in those four ways. It comes from itself, it comes from other. So the other is the one that Caroline just mentioned here, to function. Right? Something causes an effect, that's the function. An effect depends upon a cause. And they intrinsically exist. And if that's the case, as it's pointed out, then there's no relationship between them. Yeah, so things can't, if they did intrinsically exist, inherently exist, there'd be no relationship between a cause and an effect. They each have their, what they call, own nature, and there's no way for them to relate to one another. Oh, this was, I wonder if you guys got this one. This was interesting. So it says, what is the contradiction in claiming that words refuting inherent existence must themselves be inherently existent? This is, we did one like this before, I think. But simply put, they're doing two things, right? Saying it does exist, and on the other hand, saying it doesn't exist. So that's why it's like, this is contradictory.
Who's denying the inherent existence there? Who's the they?
The middle way autonomists.
But what's the inherent existence they're denying? Because if they're an autonomous, they... Or is that the contradiction?
That's the contradiction, Caroline. That's right. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Yeah, so sometimes just not what we're doing, which is a good thing, you know, that we get, just like you just said, Caroline, you put it out and you go, yeah, that's right. Yeah, we need something to bounce it off against, you know. Yeah, otherwise it's not so obvious, is it? It's like, you just get all tangled up in your own head trying to work it out.
So is that an example of the consequentialists indicating the consequence of
That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Okay, that's so as a brief summary, so the core misunderstanding is that when Chandrakirti says we have no thesis, it does not mean we have no view whatsoever. It means that our view is not one which involves inherent existence. I have no thesis that involves any phenomena existing inherently. That's what he's sort of saying. I have no thesis like that.
Mine gave, my little AI gave some other answers to Eddie. It talked about, you know, like we don't accept autonomous reasons because we don't believe that there's inherently existent theses. But also it said the Prasangikas use reasoning pragmatically to guide others towards emptiness, but they never affirm the components as ultimately real.
Yep.
And I like this one. Prasangika's aim to deconstruct inherent existence, not to build self-validating systems. Autonomous syllogisms imply a fixed reality contradicting emptiness.
Yep, excellent. Nicely, yeah. Yes, it's quite nice like that, isn't it? When you get different presentations from the different AIs. At least I did. I'll try and grab out the one that makes most sense to me. So just like that, Sue, you just take the part that, oh, I get that, I understand that, yep. So there's a, I don't know whether it comes up later, but there was a part where Nagarjuna states, if I had any thesis, then I would suffer from that result. But as I have no thesis, I alone am without faults. When you hear this, what do you think Nagarjuna is? So there's going to be two things happening. An opponent is going to hear it one way, and a middle way person is going to hear it another way. Middle way consequence person is going to hear it another way. So I'll read out the first sentence, and you tell me what the correct way of seeing this is. If I had any thesis, then I would suffer from that fault. What's that mean?
Wrong button.
Yeah.
So if I had any inherently existent thesis, then I would suffer from that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's how we should understand it. What do you think autonomous or people beneath the middle way consequence would understand them saying that?
Well, I will just assume that we've got no thesis. We don't have anything.
That's right. You're saying, I don't have a thesis. I don't have any thesis whatsoever. And this is what all this material has been basically about. And that's what we've got to sort of, in a nutshell, keep it just like that. So then, Nagarjuna, the last part, he says, but as I have no thesis, I alone am without faults. So what do you think that part means? Chris?
Because he rejects inherent existence.
Yeah, he has no thesis.
Yeah, thesis regarding that, then therefore the faults is that he would not grasp incorrectly onto phenomena as existent from their own side.
Right. Well, that's good enough to say. That's right. That's a nice way of putting it. Yeah. So he has no thesis which involve inherent existence, so he has no faults. And like I said, one of the outcomes of a fault is grasping at the intrinsic existence of them, which Chris has pointed out. So he doesn't do that because he doesn't have any belief, or he's actually seen through the false appearance of intrinsic existence. He doesn't have the faults of grabbing on them and believing that such phenomena exist. Okay, let's do a meditation and then we'll do our next little bit. So again, just settle down comfortably in your seat, drop your shoulders, let your body relax, and just try to release any tension in your face and shoulders. Let the body breathe itself naturally. And bring to mind the purpose for studying this material. So let's bring into awareness this question, which is, if words and logic were without inherent existence, could they validly refute inherent existence? Yes, they can. What's the reason? Thank you. Why is it that words and logic, which actually lack inherent existence, can validly refute inherent existence? It's because words and logic function dependently. Being without any objective existence, we can use words and logic to refute inherent existence. It's like yelling into a deep cave. Now the echo returns. It isn't a real voice, yet it does tell us something about the depth of the cave. And this has dependently arisen. Then consider, is logic less reliable if it lacks inherent existence? We have to say no. Logic is not less reliable if it lacks inherent existence. It's like the cave echo. Its power lies in dependently revealing what's present. So if you ever find yourself doubting yourself, do you mistake lack of objective existence for no meaning whatsoever? There is no need to make that mistake if we realize that meaning arises dependently. Meaning cannot and does not arise from a self that could objectively exist. So like an echo, insight arises when you let go of needing a solid source. We try to recognize and appreciate the truth of interdependence. Which is the opposite of objective existence. Again, that is breathing in and exhaling. Okay, so let's go to our next little bit. So it says here, question 10, in Chandrakirti's quote on page 243, he says, no such real things. The question is, how do we know he is referring to inherently existent real things? How do we know that? Sue, would you like to have a go at this one?
No such real things refers to inherent existence.
Yeah.
And we get this because we look at the text, and this text states that realizing there are no such real things stops afflictions.
Okay, great.
And denying them would lead to nihilism.
Yeah.
And not stopping the afflictions. Only rejecting inherent existence uproots the causes of suffering. So it's from that text statement that we know that, talking about inherent existence.
Yeah, so the two things, like you said, so we can refer to the commentary itself. We just go along there and it'll tell you. Real thing is referring to own character, or in other words, inherent existence. And then a little bit further along in the passage, it mentions the non-existence of own character leads to the cessation of the afflictions. So those are the two pieces of supporting text in the literature that we could use to support that the meaning is no such real things refers to no such things having an own character or an intrinsic nature. And in fact, the absence of this own character, the absence of this inherent existence, leads to the cessation of the afflictions. And so that's on page 243. So again, we have another question about this quote. And this has to do with this term in the quote, nothing to be refuted. It says in the statement, since there is nothing to be refuted, I refute nothing. What is nothing to be refuted refer to? Caroline, would you like to have a shot at this one?
No, I didn't get this far. I'm sorry, Eddie.
It's okay. It's okay.
So what page on the notes is this?
Ooh, this has got to be after page 243 because this is...
Right.
Yeah, this whole thing of this quote.
I only got to page 20 of the notes, so if anyone else can...
Yeah, yeah. So I think there's a few more pages to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's okay. It's, yeah, that is. Bruce, what do you think?
That I think it's saying that inherent existence doesn't exist inherently.
Yeah, excellent. Good on you. That's right.
And likewise, those who are reifying phenomena don't exist inherently either.
No, that's right. Great. Chris?
There was also some text that says that we must take it as referring to the rarefying consciousness that is refuted.
Aha. Okay. That's great. That's great too. So what does that mean?
It's that the consciousness that grasps itself lacks inherent existence as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Even though the autonomists would dispute that.
Yeah. Linda, how do you go with this quote?
So nothing to be refuted means nothing inherently existed to be refuted? No. Yes or no? I know.
Yeah, well, that's what we're going to find, isn't it? Yeah, but you're right.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the real question. What are we talking about here?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And that's why he says, so I refute nothing.
Yeah.
Later on. Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, what Chris was saying about that it refers to the subject that's to be refuted, the apprehension that grasps an inherent existence. The subject to be refuted exists conventionally but not inherently existing. But the object to be refuted, the inherent existent, doesn't exist
at all,
even conventionally.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, Sue, would you like to say anything about this at all?
I just said, yeah, the subject and the object is what we're talking about here.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
Yeah, and that the subject, the grasping at inherent existence, is actually a conventional mental event. And that with the existent object, inherent existent itself, it's a conceptual fiction. It cannot be found to be refuted ultimately.
Yeah. So it says, so what I had was, in this statement, since there is nothing to be refuted, I refute nothing, the phrase nothing to be refuted should not be understood as referring to the object that is to be refuted, i.e. inherent existence, because that would make no sense. Instead, it refers to the subject that is to be refuted, the apprehension or consciousness grasping at inherent existence. Yeah. Specifically, according to the commentary on the refutation of objections, even the refuting agent, the one who refutes, does not inherently exist. Thus, the non-existence mentioned here applies to both the refuted object and the refuting agent, in the sense that they do not exist inherently or by way of their own character. Neither of them do. Right? In summary, therefore, nothing to be refuted refers to the non-existence of a refuted object and a refuting agent that exists inherently. So in other words, inherent existence cannot exist inherently. And of course, the consciousness apprehending its absence does not exist inherently either. So really, the consciousness is just seeing what's not there, isn't it?
Can you just say that last bit again, Eddie?
Is it like this? Nothing to be refuted refers to the non-existence of a refuted object and refuting agent that exists inherently, rather than the absence of an object to be refuted altogether.
And the refuting agent, is that the subject?
Yeah, that's right. That's the consciousness. That's right.
Right. So the refuting, why couldn't they just say consciousness? The yeah. refuting agent is the consciousness.
That's right. Yeah.
Is it a valid consciousness or a mistaken one?
No, it would be valid here.
So, Eddie, is that consciousness, can that also be referred to as self?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No. So next question has to do, it's quite a, it asks, you know, why is this explained to be nothing to be refuted? And this, oh, there it is. Nothing to be refuted, that was the first one. Nothing means the non-existence of a refuted object and a refuting agent that exists by way of their own character. Then our next question is so why is this explained as nothing to be refuted? So who'd like to have a go at that one? Maybe you go, Sue. You have a go, Sue, first. See what you come up with.
I don't know, Eddie.
Okay, there's a lot. Did you get the AI pull out anything for you that you could break apart or anything?
Yeah, I've numbered some things here, but I'm just quickly reading through the numbers and no.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Anybody else feel sort of comfortable having a shot at this? Or have something to offer Bruce?
I've put down that empty is not a concrete thing to be denied.
Say it again, Bruce. You said that
emptiness is not a concrete thing to be denied.
No, that's right. So I got quite a long answer in this, but so what I've done is just put it up in different little blocks here. I'm trying to make it really short and pithy. So we're trying to explain nothing to be refuted. So the nothing that is the thing that to be refuted is any that things have own character. There's nothing that has its own character, in other words. That's what the word nothing is referring to. Anything that has its own character, or anything with intrinsic nature, inherent existence. There isn't anything that exists like that. So the first, the nothing to be refuted should be understood as the non-existence of things with intrinsic nature, or own character, which are the objects of negation by emptiness, right? Both the object of negation, inherent existence, and the subject that apprehends it, you know, the grasping awareness, neither exist inherently. So here's the second one. Neither the object nor the refuting agent exist with an own character. And this statement also avoids the misunderstanding, spelling mistake here, that the middle way consequence have no assertions whatsoever. Of course, the other schools are thinking the middle way consequence aren't making any assertions, right? Because from their point of view, if you negate inherent existence, you negate all conventional phenomena. But the middle way consequence is saying, no, it doesn't mean that. We are not denying conventional existence. We're denying a conventional existence that has its own character, its own nature, and inherent nature. That's what we deny. And we deny this conventionally and ultimately.
So, Eddie, who's saying that there's nothing to be refuted?
Chandler Kurdi in that little quote. Yeah, I have no thesis.
So would you be right to say that refuting would constitute a double negative, basically?
I think I see where you're going to, Bruce. Yeah, so
yeah, like you're denying something that's denying something, you know.
Yeah, that's right. It's like
yeah,
that's right. You're you're like that. That's right. I guess it's like
Well, the first one, you're denying the non-existence of things, so that's a double negative, isn't it? Is that what you're getting at, Bruce?
I think so. I've confused myself now.
I agree. I think there's too many double negatives. Because it says explaining nothing to be refuted.
Yep, that's right.
So the non-existence of things with own character is what you're refuting.
That's right. Anything with own character or intrinsic nature. Well, there isn't anything that exists like that.
The title says that you're explaining things that are not to be refuted here.
The term is nothing. What is the nothing that is to be refuted? Explain the nothing.
So is it explaining the nothing that the autonomous people say can't be refuted, but we say can be refuted?
That's right. That's fine. Because those guys, the autonomous, they know these things actually exist with their own character.
Yeah.
Right? So you come along and say, I don't even actually need to refute that because they don't have an own character. There is nothing to be refuted. None of these phenomena exist by way of their own character.
No.
The idea that they have an own character, yeah. And the grasping at it by the consciousness is, yeah. The misbelief that the phenomena have an own character, sure. But the things themselves don't have an own character.
It's like illusion-like refutation of illusion-like subject by illusion-like object.
That's right. In fact, I remember Sakya Trisada, one of those calendars, said something just like that. The illusory self engaged in an illusory path to attain an illusory enlightenment.
I get all your boxes. I just am struggling with the relationship between the title and the boxes, but I'll work on it.
Fair enough, Caroline. Yeah, try and do that. So, in brief, when Chandler Kurdi, talks about no such real things, he's referring to inherent phenomena, anything with an unchanging nature. And so what's the difference between inherent existence from mere conventional existence? So remember, inherent existence and conventional existence, from the middle way autonomous point of view, they're one and the same, aren't they? That's what you gotta remember. From the middle way autonomous and backwards, anything that conventionally exists does so by way of their own character, and they inherently exist. That's conventional existence for them. So when we come to the middle way consequence, they bring in this term like merely conventional, meaning that when you look for the inherent existence that they seem to have, it's not there. They merely exist, depend upon name mainly, and consciousness. So that's why it's important, this word mere, that's brought in, merely conventional. It's to sort of help us understand the difference between these two words, conventional, used in the two different systems. So what it says, so does nothing to be refuted mean nothing exists? Of course, no. That's a simple, we can say, no, we don't mean that. No, it means that the nothing exists inherently or independently or by way of their own character. So here's an interesting one. What is the subject of refutation in emptiness? Linda, tell us, Linda, you've got this little thing on.
Inherent existence. The object to be refuted. Tell me the question again.
Yeah, okay, I was going to say, you went too fast. Okay, the question is, what is the subject of a refutation in emptiness?
The subject that you're refuting. So not the object of refuting, but the subject.
Right. Yeah, that's okay. Right. That's
so right. The consciousness that apprehends inherent existence.
And grasps at it.
Oh, and grasp at it, okay.
It's got to, because it has to believe it. Because it's always going to appear, but it's not always believed to exist in that way.
Okay.
Yeah, so the subject is the grasping at the appearance. Yeah. Okay, we'll do one more meditation and then we'll have a little break. So again, just get yourselves comfortable. Get your body settled. And just let your breath flow naturally. And then create a wish that this meditation will help us all achieve enlightenment. So we begin by looking at Chandrakirti's insight that no such real things exist inherently. The things appear to exist independently, to have their own character, their own intrinsic existence, but they actually lack such a way of existing. They appear one way, they exist in another way. And this is a sort of middle way between eternalism and nihilism. So using the middle way consequence understanding of non-inherent existence, the emptiness of that, and merely dependently existing, this can liberate us from afflictive emotions and suffering. So you must all remember those stories of somebody traveling in the desert and they mistake a mirage for water. Well, we mistake appearances to be inherently existent things. So when you look at objects around you, can you distinguish between their conventional appearance and the assumption they exist from their own side? So now just take a moment to consider something that you really cherish, something that you hold dearly. Ask yourself, does that object appear to exist not dependent upon you, upon a labeling mind? Does it appear to exist independent of its causes, conditions, parts, and your labeling mind? Remember, just look at the appearance. Does it appear to exist dependently or not dependently? If it appears not dependent, this is the mirage-like nature of things. This is the illusion-like nature of phenomena. If we recognize this illusion-like nature, this would change our relationship to it. Aversion and attachment would immediately fall away. So there's like a little exercise you could play with. Try to see the environment as appearing and empty, like a reflection in a mirror. So the reflection is present, but what it reveals is not in the mirror. So the environment appears, but it doesn't exist like over there from its own side. Try and rest in the awareness, that spacious type of awareness that knows both appearance and emptiness simultaneously. And now just breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, blink your eyes. So we have a, says here, referring to page 247, how is the middle way system presented as free for from fault? Any ideas? Anybody happy to throw up an answer? Chris, you'd like to go first?
Sure, Eddie. There seems to have been two things on this. It's the middle way system does not accept intrinsic nature.
Yep.
And the belief that objects and phenomena are like illusions, these are the primary reasons for the middle way content system to be free from fault.
That's very nice, mate. That's the way, nice and succinct. Yeah. Linda, did you have a shot at this?
Yeah, very similar to what Chris said. So just that the middle way system, so that cause and effect are like an illusion, that cause and effect are dependently arisen, they don't have any intrinsic existence, and therefore they don't have that fault, whereas the other schools, they say that cause and effect, producers and produced, are inherently existent and they have the fault.
Yeah, that's basically right. Yeah, so before we knew about emptiness and lack of intrinsic nature, did anybody try and, you know, when you try and put cause and effect together without knowing about lack of intrinsic nature, but we're doing it with intrinsic nature, aren't we? Right? We're just like the autonomous, like Caroline pointed out, right? It's all appearing to us as if it inherently exists. We don't know it's empty of that. So we're trying to put together things with the understanding that they inherently exist, even though we might not know the words. So, when you've ever tried to fit together like a cause and an effect, anybody ever discover how hard that was? That you really can't do it? Because if they're separate, it's like, well, so if a cause is separate from the effect, how can it affect, how can it produce the effect? So you go, well, it can't, can it? Yet if they're joined together, like, they're not cause and effect anymore. And that comes back to that argument they use, isn't it? Not intrinsically the same, not intrinsically different. So intrinsic means your inherent nature. So I remember that always used to confuse me and just drive me nuts, how like you'd go, well, if they're separate like they appear to us, then how can they can't have any effect on one another? But if they're one and the same, then that doesn't make sense either. And so that's these two views are the views of the essentialists. Things essentially having an intrinsic nature. But when you like try to put it together, it doesn't work. When you just leave it alone and leave it just on appearance, it's fine, isn't it? It's when you start to dig deep and go, actually, I want to have a look. Then this all falls apart. It doesn't make sense. And so this is what these guys are getting at, you know. Like you say, they exist like illusions. You know, the middle way consequences don't have any of these problems because they, like, you know, the problem I'm having with, like, hang on a minute, if they're different and separate from one another, like a seed is not the plant, is it? If they're quite separate from one another, how can they produce the effect? That's like an essentialist view, you know? These things essentially exist. Of course, if it's rejected, like the middle way consequence do, then it all works. But it doesn't work when they have their own nature.
So, Eddie, who are the essentialists now?
Anybody beneath the middle way consequence. They're all essentialists.
Right.
Yeah. What are those?
Eddie, your original question just about, you know, before I understood anything about emptiness or like that was, I always remember, like, you know, post-school in uni as a chemistry student.
Yeah.
And, you know, for example, we would do precipitation reactions. So you would have, you know, a solution perhaps that would have something like, say, lime, for example, and then you would add a carbonate to it and you get a precipitation afterwards. But at the time, though, I would just think that is real, you know, the you know, if you put these two things together, add a little bit of temperature, swirl them around, you'll get your precipitate, you know, the precipitate forms, and it appears to exist from its own side.
Yeah, that's right.
I just remember that, I like it strongly though, Eddie, you know, and so yeah, there's quite a lot to unwind, haven't done that for years, you know.
Inheritism. The fault in the essentialist position arises from accepting intrinsic existence of cause and effect, whereas the middle way holds that things are like illusions, lacking intrinsic nature, and are merely imputed by mind. This belief avoids the fallacy that afflicts the essentialists. Moreover, things of the world exist conventionally when left unanalyzed. But when analyzed in terms of inherent existence, they cannot be found. This nuanced understanding shows how the middle way system avoids the faults of the other positions, and this is free from fault. Question 14 asks, what is the core assertion of Chandrakirti and Nagarjuna's quotes about the middle way system? Sue, would you like to have a go at this one first?
I had that. Is this still part of the other question, Eddie? It
yeah,
goes that's, on.
Yeah,
it does.
Yeah.
Okay. The core essence is that the systems. Can you hear me? Yep. Articulated by Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, avoid philosophical extremes by grounding itself in dependent arising and emptiness.
That's very nice.
And mine gave, here's how it remains free from fault, per insights on page 247 in key quotes. And there were five subheadings.
Uh-huh.
So they remain grounded by avoiding the two extremes.
Yeah.
Because they refute eternalism and nihilism.
Yes.
And they say this because phenomena conventionally function through causes and conditions, but lack inherent existence.
Yeah.
Number two, they say grounded, independent, arising in emptiness, because Chandrakirti clarifies conventional validity.
Yeah.
He asserts that conventional truths, such as cause and effects, ethical actions are dependently designated and function without inherent existence. Conventional truths are tools for communication and practice, not inherently real.
Yeah.
And number three, he does this, they stay in these things between dependent rise and emptiness by refuting faults through illusion-like logic. The middle way uses conventional logic to refute inherent existence, even though the logic itself appears, it is empty. The logic is empty. Oh. Empty reputations dismantle empty misconceptions, nice. Like illusions countering illusion. So that's nice. Number four, they do it by resolving objections about no positions. You know, the critics argue or the essentialists argue if words refute inherent existence are empty, how can we they refute anything? He replies that we don't fall into similar absurdities because neither the reputation nor what it refutes intrinsically exists. And the last one, they don't fall into any faults because the role of the two truths. They accept cause and effect, ethical actions and logic as dependently valid conventional truths and ultimate truths. Emptiness negates inherent existence but does not negate dependent arising.
Thank you,
so yeah, that was the five.
Okay, so in brief you summarize it all up from the middle way consequence. So while phenomena all lack inherent existence, they do exist dependently and conventionally. And finally, this position avoids the extremes of eternalism and nihilism. So just try to go from one side to the other, you know, try and get a something from Chandrakirti and something by Nagarjuna. Then we have this last couple of questions about this third misinterpretation. And of course the third misinterpretation is, which is, has the third misinterpretation, which is the middle way consequentialists have no thesis, but only refute others, being resolved? I think we could all say, yeah, it has, hasn't it? Yeah, we should say, yes, that's the first thing we could say, yep. And not only that, but it has been resolved, and their way of resolving is to reject these autonomous theses. They reject inherent existence. So this has come about through this misunderstanding. And then they put forward the idea that, yes, we do have theses, and these are conventional and dependent. They're not autonomous and exist by way of their own character with their own nature.
Eddie, is it worth adding a qualifier that it's been resolved from middle way consequence perspective, but not an autonomous perspective, because they've not changed their views?
Yeah, that's fine. That's right. It's okay. Yeah. And then there's this last question. So this is like, I'll answer this one a bit like Sue's answer just beforehand, right? You get like five answers in the one. So it says, if this misinterpretation has been clarified, like, how is it addressed? So remember this misinterpretation here is that the middle way have no thesis to offer. And so how is this misunderstanding arisen in the first place, folks?
Because the other schools decided that because middle way consequence said there were no autonomous theses, there were no theses at all, because they disagree with it.
And that's right. Basically, that's right. So they've looked at that quote by Nagarjuna, who says, I have no thesis, thinking, okay, the middle way have no thesis. They've sort of taken it as like a literal understanding, which if you think about it, that's basically what they've done with the phenomena, isn't it? They've taken, look, it looks this way, it is that way. He said this, he said we have no thesis, it means they don't have any at all. And that's where this whole misunderstanding has arisen. So the first thing to say, look, when Nagarjuna says, well, I have no thesis, he's saying, I have no thesis which are autonomous. I have no autonomous thesis. There's actually no contradiction here. When he says, I have no thesis, he's being direct. He's just telling you, yeah, the only missing thing is I have no autonomous thesis. That's what's not there, you know, the word autonomous. Then they go on to say that, you know, valid cognitions and refutations are accepted conventionally by the middle way consequence, right? But they're without any own character. So again, the difference being the middle way autonomy is saying we have valid cognitions and these refutations, but they have their own character. Again, we have this thing where the middle way rejects all the essentialist, these rational analysis, because they're always assuming own character. And finally, the middle way does have its own beliefs, assertions and thesis. In fact, they use the same, you know, the use of the syllogism that the middle way autonomous is exactly the same that the middle way consequences use, the difference being no own character. Yeah, so we've been basically going through this today's teaching, and it's been about this misinterpretation of the quote. This, you know, the middle way autonomous are understanding it one way, and the middle way consequences understand it in another way. And so they've been a bit of argy-bargy about it. Is there anything you'd like to say about this, what the material we've gone through?
Those meditations were nice, Eddie.
Okay, well.
Thank you.
It's clearer now than it was.
Yeah, I'm.
For sure.
I think what could happen is a little bit of time will go by and then our clarity will disappear again. It just seems to work that way, you know. We're like I say, you know, things are appearing to us as they appear to the autonomists. Right? So like I say, when you see quotes like that saying, therefore I have no thesis, we could just take it literally, like the other guys do. Right? So you need to remember, hang on, the middle way consequence do have thesis, they do have reasons. So this can't be the literal meaning. I can't just because it's written like this can't be literally true.
There was, towards the end of the commentary, there was all these quotations, and it mentioned that it was full of expressions like I believe and I accept and I posit, and this was taken as evidence that there is something there.
Yeah.
There is a thesis there because these expressions are referring to that thesis.
Yeah.
And I think in I think Rinpoche's commentary sort of lays it down that autonomous means the same thing as inherent existence, and the other way means that consequence means there is no inherent existence. So I'm going to try and use that as a mantra.
Let's make it as simple as possible for ourselves, eh? Yeah, it's like this, also this term essentialist that comes up. You know, they're going, well, essential means inherent existence, inherent nature. There's some sort of essential thing there, right, on its own. And you go, okay, right, that's all the other schools but the middle way consequence. Okay, let's finish up and do our last meditation then. So again, just get comfortable in your seat. Let your body become still and the breath to be natural. You can dedicate this meditation practice to understanding the subtle wisdom of the middle way consequence for the benefit of all beings. So the middle way consequence do indeed have assertions and they do have positions. So how do these assertions and positions exist? Do they exist conventionally or inherently? So the consequence of misunderstanding that these assertions and positions exist inherently is either to fall into the extremes of nihilism or eternalism. And we miss the profound middle path. So we've all had instances where we've had a dream, a very vivid dream. And when we've been dreaming, everything feels utterly real. It's not a dream to us. Yet upon waking, we realize it was a dream. It has no intrinsic existence. It has no objective reality. It has no own character. In the same way, every other phenomena exists just like that dream. It conventionally exists. It has no inherent reality. So what position does the middle way consequence actually hold? So the middle way consequence assert the emptiness of inherent existence while accepting conventional reality. And this conventional reality dependently arises. So how does this view avoid contradicting itself? It avoids contradiction when we understand that the assertions themselves are empty of inherent existence. They exist only conventionally. They exist in mere name. Might this understanding transform our daily experiences? We just recognize that things function perfectly well without any essential nature. Phenomena have no core essence, no own character, no own nature. And because they do not have that nature, they function. So let's try to recognize conventional reality, that it functions without requiring inherent nature or an essential nature or an own character. The phenomena exist in mere name, being unfindable when searched for. So try to appreciate the sort of balanced understanding, dependently arising without intrinsic nature. So this liberates us from the two extremes of not existing at all or having an eternal form of existence. So abiding in neither extreme breathe in through your nostrils and exhale through your mouth. And let your eyes blink and bring your awareness back to the seat and where you're sitting. So today we went through like these 16 questions. We don't come back for about a month, I think, for the next lesson. So I've got all the questions done. I had sent them all, given them all to Miffy, but she's been really snowed under and she didn't put them up online. That's why you didn't get them. But I've already got them all written out. So what I could do is either send them off to you, Bruce, or Linda, somebody there, and please just share them out amongst you. So you know, okay, I've got the next set of questions. I've got plenty of warning here. So we've got today 19, and I think we only do about like 9 or 10 questions there. It's another biggie, so I thought I'd just cut it in half, make it a bit more comprehensible for us.
Eddie, I'm going to be away for a few weeks at the Noonay, so maybe send it to Bruce, love.
Okay, thank you. Okay. So let's dedicate our material then. Oh, what do? I took it off. Let it come back here. Okay. Day 19. Yeah. So in case you do want to write anything down, this is where it's sort of going from. Okay. So thinking of Kensa Rinpoche, being inseparable from Lama Tsongkhapa. In fact, all the lineage lamas, like His Holiness, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, all embodied in this form of Lama Tsongkhapa. Then consider our own merit that we've created, it depends upon these really kind teachers. Join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha, and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And for Rinpoche's recognition, in holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armour of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this request.